I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we start with news from Afghanistan. On day three of the major offensive into the Taliban stronghold of Marja in southern Afghanistan, yesterday the mission faced a serious setback, U.S. officials apologizing after thinking a rocket attack missed its target and hit a home, killing 12 civilians. As a British NATO official said, the mission is about protecting the local population, and you don't do that when you kill them. But Rod Nordland, a New York Times correspondent in Afghanistan, is in Kabul, his colleagues embedded with U.S. and Afghan troops. And Rod, the ISAF, the International Security Assistance Force, did apologize, but you say today it might not have been a mistake and there were fewer casualties?
In fact, the Afghans came out today and said, no, it wasn't 12 civilians, it was 9 civilians and 3 Taliban. Apparently, they're saying now that it wasn't a mistake. They did hit the right building. That, you know, probably the fire was directed by either a helicopter or a drone or something, and they did see where the shooting was coming from. You know, when you're the guy on the ground getting shot at, it's often hard to tell what building it's coming from. But the guys up in aerial reconnaissance and all maybe sometimes have a better picture. So it turns out they think they directed the fire to the right house. It's just unfortunate that the Taliban in that house were there with a bunch of civilians as well.
Well, and, you know, to some, it would be a small consolation that there would be, you know, 3 less deaths. But why is this as important to you?
The fact that there were armed fighters in the house that they fired on does make the house a legitimate target. But the striking thing is that they were so quick to try to take responsibility because they wanted to show that this is no longer the military force that for months would deny that they killed 100 people at a wedding party, which has happened in the past.
And in fact, we're reading in your reports in the Times today that when that rocket hit, Marines stopped their offensive, rushed over despite sniper fire. There were children who were in that house and tried very hard to help the wounded.
Yes, as it happened, my colleague Chris Chivers was there and saw the fire coming from the house and saw the missile hit a house. And the Marines at first thought that they had hit the wrong house. When they saw civilians come out, they ceased fire. And I'm sure what was some considerable risk to themselves crossed no man's land to go to that house and to render assistance to the family inside.
In fact, in reading, it seems as if at one point the helicopter that was coming in to aid the wounded was almost hit by Taliban. So this could have been a very different story.
Yeah, it could have been the first really serious loss of life on ISAF's side. I mean, it's a dangerous thing to exercise a lot of caution about civilians because the other side can use that to their advantage.
Well, Rod, tell us what happens now, because we understand that part of the thinking was that instead of moving the Taliban out and taking over the area and then perhaps leaving, an entire town is going to be brought in. The infrastructure of a town will be brought in, police, people to run the town. What happens next?
Well, I think we're still a ways away from them bringing along their government in a box as they've been touting it. But they've apparently spent quite a lot of time and money to prepare this infrastructure, everything from schools to job programs and so on, and put them in place quickly, get it up and running so that people in Marja will see an immediate improvement in their circumstances. But before all that can happen, they've got to clear Marja, and even if there aren't that many Taliban left, there are enough there to cause a lot of problems for them with sniping, and there are apparently just an enormous number of hidden bombs and IEDs that have to be cleared before they can really do anything.
So what's your sense of how long this operation with, you know, some sniper fires, discovery of some Taliban, scattered fighting, how long do you think that will take?
We're hearing from our guys down there, and what they're saying is most of it will be over in a few days, but clearing out all the explosives and everything else could take quite a long time. And in fact, the Brigadier General Nicholson, who's the U.S. Marine commander, was quoted as saying that he thinks it'll take 30 days before it's completely cleared. And then putting this new government up is not just as simple as rolling a box in. That's going to take some time, too.
Rod Nordland, New York Times correspondent in Kabul, Afghanistan, his colleagues embedded with U.S. troops in Marja in southern Afghanistan. Rod, thanks so much for talking to us.
You're welcome. Glad to help.
Well, the U.S. is reportedly scaling back its aid mission in Haiti. Troop strength there down to 13,000 from a peak of 20,000, though Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the U.S. will be in Haiti for the long haul. And the conversation about how to help Haiti continues. Former Haitian presidential candidate Dumas Simius, now of Texas, wrote a letter this week to the UN calling for that organization to expand its role to governing Haiti. He says the current government should step aside immediately. And Partners in Health founder Dr. Paul Farmer has called for a massive public works program to improve agriculture and reforest the country. But our next guest says, to help Haitians, let them leave. Michael Clemens writes about his idea in Foreign Policy magazine. He's a research fellow at the Center for Global Development. He joins us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Michael, you say that more than half of Haitians live on less than a dollar a day, and to help them increase that, allow as many 100,000 to leave right now. How would that help?
Unfortunately, leaving Haiti has been the single force which has lifted more Haitians out of poverty than anything else that has happened in Haiti. The vast majority of Haitians who have emerged from poverty, who used to be desperately poor and no longer are, did so outside of Haiti.
Right. You read, a typical low-skill male Haitian in the U.S. earns at least six times what he could earn in Haiti. But then the more important thing becomes what Haitian expats do with that money. Talk about remittance.
The roughly 1 million Haitians who live outside Haiti send about a little less than $2 billion per year, that's pre-earthquake, home, roughly double foreign aid flows, and roughly a quarter of Haiti's economy. Unlike foreign aid flows, that money goes directly into the pockets of families that need it.
So you say that unlike foreign aid, let's say all the aid that's flowing into Haiti now, the disaster relief, remittances never stop.
Absolutely. They're renewable. I don't want to criticize the foreign aid efforts at all. They're extremely important in the short term. But if we're talking about a renewable resource, remittances are it.
So your proposal is to allow more Haitians to leave, maybe as many as 100,000, which is, I think, the same number that you say might leave Haiti over the course of 5 years. You say, you know, speed it up, have them leave now, and under a new kind of visa. Tell us about that.
Yes. What I'm proposing is more general than just Haiti. I'm proposing a new class of visa to the United States. I call it the Golden Door Visa, named after the poem on the base of the Statue of Liberty, because its express purpose would be to offer economic opportunity to people who need more opportunity. Right now, under current law, there's not one single visa that can be given to a person just because they need opportunity.
You mentioned the Golden Door and the poem, "Give me your tired, your poor," on the base of the Statue of Liberty. I'm trying to remember the line.
She lifts her lamp beside the golden door,
right.
Is what Emma Lazarus says about the Statue of Liberty.
Right. Well, as you know, this has caused quite a bit of reflection on this idea. Let's ask you some questions. First of all, wouldn't adding to a diaspora of Haitians leaving the country leave it even more impoverished? You'd be letting the physically fit, the people who can work and send money back, leave. And doesn't that further rob Haiti of its young, its strong, those with the ability to work?
I think that's a really important concern. But I do want to point out that the people who have left Haiti in the past are now, as we mentioned, sending home billions of dollars a year precisely to the people who haven't left who need it. So they're an incredibly important resource.
Well, but Haiti is so on its knees, to begin with. And
yes.
So there's a question of how much more can you strip away. But also, what are these people going to? The Haitians that come to the U.S., they'll find a U.S. with a 9%, if you factor in everybody who wants to work, unemployment. What jobs will they get?
I want to be very clear that what I'm proposing is a class of visa and not a number of visas. I'm proposing reserving what could be a very small number of total immigrant visas for people from places like Haiti who desperately need opportunity. That could be in the context of lowering, keeping the same, or increasing the total number of immigrants. And I do think it's important for the total number of immigrants to respond flexibly to economic conditions here in the U.S.
Well, a lot of people have spoken out against this idea. Predictably, Ira Melman, the spokesperson for the Federation for American Immigration Reform, they have concerns about the Obama administration's announcement that Haitians already in the U.S. will be allowed to stay for 18 more months. So they're concerned about extending immigration stays, certainly wouldn't be in favor of adding to the number of immigrants. And Janet Napolitano, the Secretary of Homeland Security, has tried to dissuade people leaving Haiti. is, again, she feels it'll bring more hardship to the country.
That's very difficult for me to understand. I think a good way to think about it would be to imagine whether or not allowing people who wanted voluntarily to leave New Orleans after Katrina devastated New Orleans would hurt or help their own prospects and New Orleans' prospects. I don't understand the notion that forcing people to stay in a place that they want to leave is good for them or that place, especially when that place has been horrifyingly devastated by death and destruction.
Well, in a recent Gallup poll showed that while a majority of Americans said the U.S. should provide support to Haiti, 53% were against allowing more Haitians into the U.S. in the wake of the earthquake. There's a climate right now that seems to be fearful of this kind of thing. So obviously you said what's in it for Haitians, but what's in it for America to have 100,000 Haitians come?
Well, I think most Americans are very practical people, and they want to help Haiti. And the vast majority of Haitians who have left poverty over the last couple of generations have done so by leaving Haiti. Even letting a small number of additional Haitians leave could be incredibly powerful, and it's much cheaper than donating money or paying taxes to give foreign aid. And I also want to stress again that I'm not talking about necessarily letting more immigrants in. I'm talking about allotting just a few of the visas we have to people who need it the most, and we currently lack a legal mechanism for doing that.
Right. And as you say, this allows Haitians to help Haiti by being the ones who send the money back into the country as opposed to foreign aid.
Very much, and they're in the best position to do that.
Well, what about increasing investment in Haiti? Just before the earthquake, there was some hope because of new garment makers that were investing in Haiti. 10,000 new garment industry jobs were created in Port-au-Prince last year. Wouldn't it be better to build from within, to have the money generated within the country, all the money?
Absolutely. That is the ideal. The problem is that achieving that has proven incredibly difficult. The average living standard in Haiti has not just remained flat over the last 30 years, it's declined, and it's declined by half. So every effort from the outside, trade preferences that we have for Haiti, billions of dollars in aid, things that are important and were valuable to try, have not succeeded at preventing that enormous fall. During that same period, the vast majority of Haitians who were able to leave poverty did it by leaving. So going forward, I don't think that promoting investment should be ignored. I don't think that humanitarian assistance should be ignored. But if we're going to come up with a serious strategy for helping Haitians, it's got to have as a major pillar that which has worked best in the past, and that's migration.
That's Michael Clemens. He's a research fellow at the Center for Global Development and an affiliate professor of public policy at Georgetown University. Again, his ideas let a huge number of Haitians leave now for the U.S. so they can do, as he just said, as they'd historically done, send money back to Haiti. Well, what's been the response to his idea? Some of it not so good, as we're going to hear. Then another proposal is the solution to Haiti's housing woes, little fiberglass homes. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Just a couple of minutes to finish our conversation with Michael Clemens, a research fellow at the Center for Global Development. His idea to help Haitians by letting more of them leave with a new type of U.S. visa called a Golden Door visa. It would redirect the number of visas already allocated so that more go to a new category of people in need like Haitians, so that they could then send back more remittances to Haiti. Now, remittance money already exceeds the money flowing into Haiti from foreign aid. And, Michael, we were thinking maybe Haitians who send remittances back could get some sort of tax credit for doing that here in the U.S.
That sounds like a tremendous idea because with respect to the U.S. economy, we're talking about an extremely small number. But with respect to the Haitian economy, any small leveraging of what has become by far the most important financial resource coming from the outside for Haitians would have untold value for them.
Well, Michael Clemens, what's been the response? Have you heard from the government about your idea that we should create a new type of visa that would allow more Haitians into the U.S.?
No. We're meeting with labor unions and some congressional staffers to see if this is a possibility. And I've gotten hate mail on a scale that I could not have possibly predicted.
Well, tell us more about that.
I think that a lot of people experience a lot of fear when the topic of conversations turns to migration. And many, many people who read my ideas assumed that I was advocating bringing all of Haiti or any Haitian who wants to come to the U.S. And really what I was talking about was creating some mechanism for some small degree of flexibility in migration policy, which could amount to a very small number of people, because I understand that even a small number of Haitians leaving can do enormous good for Haitians and for Haiti. So predictably, I was flooded with hate mail. The head of a prominent anti-immigrant activist group here in Washington called me a name on his blog meant to suggest that I'm a Nazi. I think that it arises from a misunderstanding of what's really a very sensible, practical, low-cost, huge-impact policy proposal.
That's Michael Clemens. He's a research fellow at the Center for Global Development and affiliate professor of public policy at Georgetown University. His idea, let more Haitians leave Haiti so that they can send a portion of the money they make outside the country back in the form of remittances. Professor Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, for Haitians who stay in Haiti, housing is a huge concern, especially now that the rainy season is coming. A quarter of a million homes were destroyed in last month's earthquake. Survivors still scrambling for tents, building shanties with anything they can get their hands on. On this program, we've spoken with housing experts who advocate turning shipping containers into temporary homes. And Clemson University professor Doug Hecker says those huge rectangular steel boxes would be a good solution in Haiti's earthquake zone. How about another one? How about little fiberglass homes? That's one solution that our next guest is proposing. His company makes fiberglass homes. Now, we should say, in making the homes, they use a big machine that vacuums hazardous fiberglass dust away, so workers building the homes or people living in them won't breathe it in. He joins us now from Union, Mississippi. That's John Pardue, sales and marketing director for the startup company Durasip. He's also a former inspector for the Federal Emergency Management Agency. John, further describe these homes.
A Durasip home is made of a fiberglass sandwich panel, and the fiberglass skins, which are very much like the hull of a boat, would be the bread, and in between where the meat would be the expanded polystyrene, which would be, you know, similar to a white coffee cup.
Okay, well, you mentioned the foam inside the panels, and many of those coffee cups that you compare them to are floating around the ocean, you know, because they're not biodegradable. So just, is it something that's just going to add to sort of garbage that we can't get rid of after a time?
Well, that's a very good question. It's not biodegradable, which is why it makes an excellent, durable building material. Our houses will literally last indefinitely.
And so your thinking is no one's going to want to dispose of them. They're going to last forever. And
that's exactly right.
Well, and what about the durability? We think fiberglass, glass, you know, and we're talking about earthquake and hurricane zones.
Yes. The homes are made out of large panels, and they're highly durable to seismic because they have low inertia and low weight, so that in an earthquake, they wouldn't fall down and crush people to death like the concrete homes did in Haiti. And they're also highly resistant to wind, so it's an extremely strong building system.
Well, we know you're lining up a small pilot project in Haiti to help people there, but it's with a for-profit disaster relief contractor.
Yes.
Do you worry about, you know, what that looks like, that, you know, profiting off of someone's disaster?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm glad that you brought that up. Mm-hmm. We are selling a very modestly priced little home for as little as $3,000. There's not a whole lot of profit in a house that only costs that much. Also, having been employed, I was a contract inspector for FEMA for many years, and I've made my living helping people to recover from disasters. And I think that is a lot different than profiting on people's agony.
Well, we understand eventually you want the work to be done there as well.
That's correct. The foam itself is 99% air, so it doesn't transport very efficiently across the ocean. So what we will do is send our skins, we call them the laminates, into either Dominican Republic or Haiti, and then laminate them and make the panels there on site by locally produced foam. That also will create jobs and some opportunity for the people there on the island as well.
Well, John, we understand you've been contacted by church groups here in the U.S. heading to Haiti, and also orphanages in Haiti, people who want to take these homes there.
That's correct. They would send their volunteer labor down here to Mississippi, where we would train them free of charge on the construction and how to put our homes together. and at which point they could meet their container down there in Haiti and install them on site. With three or four people, it is seriously only a couple of hours of work with no skilled labor necessary at all or any kind of special tools.
John Pardue is sales and marketing director for Durasip, a startup company in Union, Mississippi that makes small fiberglass homes for disaster relief. For more information, by the way, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have a conversation about science and faith with openly religious Dr. Francis Collins. He's director of the National Institutes of Health. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, former Arizona congressman and conservative radio talk show host J.D. Hayworth on taking on John McCain, even though McCain has all those Tea Party superstars behind him. But the latest news is next, Here and Now. After 2 days of weather-related postponements, alpine skiing gets underway today with the men's downhill. And don't worry if you're watching on delay tonight. We're not going to give anything away. But we will say that yesterday, Vancouver was more than 10 degrees warmer than it was in Dallas, Texas. Joining us from balmy Vancouver is Boston Globe sports reporter Shira Springer. And Shira, the weather has just been playing havoc with the alpine skiing, hasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, they are just getting... The men's downhill started in Whistler today when it was scheduled to go off on Saturday. They have been shipping in snow and treating the course at Cypress Mountain, where the freestyle events and the snowboarding is taking place, around the clock to make sure that's ready. We just learned that they're having to do away with some standing room spectator areas because the rain has wreaked havoc with those places, and they're no longer suitable for spectators.
I'm just wondering, what are officials saying about this? Because I heard Bob Costas say that he looked back over, I think, 70 years of this week in Vancouver history and found that it had snowed maybe seven times while it rained 47 times. This wasn't unknown.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, when the IOC first reviewed Vancouver's bid, that was their main concern, the potential for warmth and rain. Vancouver residents will tell you, oh, it was snowy and wonderful here last year, but this is not unusual. Yeah. Vancouver is known as sort of a very temperate winter climate.
Well, there might be one Olympian happy with all of this, and that's Lindsey Vonn, who took her first training runs this past weekend after that severe shin bruise. How is she looking?
Well, according to her husband, who is also her coach and close advisor, she looks very good. The question is not how, you know, if she'll compete, but how well she'll compete and how ready she'll be when the women's events start. She has a lot of rust to shake off. She really hasn't done any aggressive skiing since February 2nd.
Well, looking backwards a little bit, Canada's probably still celebrating its first gold medal ever on home turf. It's in men's moguls. That's the victory of Alexander Bilodeau. They were hoping for gold in the women's as well, but sorry, that went to Vermonter Hannah Carney. And the U.S. is also celebrating the U.S. Nordic skiing team's first ever medal, Johnny Spillane winning silver yesterday in the Nordic combined. This is sort of ski jumping and cross-country skiing. And someone, I can't remember who, compared it to the curse of the Red Sox being lifted. Just your thoughts on the medals already.
Yeah, it's been quite impressive. I was there when Hannah Carney won her gold medal in the moguls. And like you said, the crowd was really anticipating the first Canadian gold. But she skied an absolutely perfect run. And then at her medal ceremony, they were able to announce Bilodeau's win. And the place went absolutely wild. Speaking of the Red Sox curse, it was like a Red Sox winning a world championship. You know, people just out in the streets celebrating, people driving by honking their horns, screaming, shouting, "Go Canada, go!" That was the level of excitement over Canada's first win. And with regard to the silver in Nordic combined, it's been expected that at this Olympics, the U.S. will finally have some of those breakthroughs where they do win medals in sports where they haven't been traditionally strong. There's hope now in women's luge that there will be a medal with Erin Hamlin. So look for that trend of winning medals in those sort of niche sports to continue.
Well, other events today, the men's snowboard cross, the men's 500-meter race in speed skating, and the pairs free skate. But, Chair, we just want to touch on something we've been feeling back here, and maybe it's because of the death of the Georgian luger. But everything feels dangerous, whether it's the insane speed of the moguls or the tension of the speed skating. What's your sense there?
You're absolutely right, and it does have to do with the death of the Georgian loser. People here are looking at the sports that are contested at Winter Olympics in a new way, and they realize the inherent danger in so many of them, from the short track speed skating to the moguls to the snowboarding, which we know about all too well because of the injury to Kevin Pierce.
Right.
And so I think there's a little bit of spectators, when there's a big crash, it used to be, ooh, and now it's like, oh, and there's, you know, and it takes a little bit of time for people to exhale and make sure the athlete is okay, because they know what the end result can be now.
Boston Globe sports reporter Shira Springer in Vancouver. Shira, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Okay, coming up in 30 seconds, former Congressman J.D. Hayworth mounting a challenge to Senator John McCain in Arizona. That's in about half a minute, here and now. John McCain hasn't faced a serious challenge for his Senate seat since he was first elected in 1986. But today, J.D. Hayworth, a former sportscaster turned congressman turned radio talk show host, will officially enter the August Republican primary. And McCain has been crossing the state with an endorsement event today. In a moment, we'll speak with his challenger, J.D. Hayworth. But first, Dan Nowicki of the Arizona Republic newspaper. And Dan, is this about Hayworth or about the Tea Party movement to unseat incumbents?
He's a known quantity to Arizona Republicans. Obviously, he's not born of the Tea Party, but he's definitely trying to tap into the Tea Party and kind of ride some of the anti-incumbent momentum this year.
Well, but that's so interesting, because we know that John McCain has the endorsement of Sarah Palin, despite, you know, reports of friction between their two camps when they ran for the White House. And he also has the endorsement of Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, both those people embraced by the Tea Party.
And in fact, he also had a coup in former House Majority Leader Dick Armey, who's now chairman of Freedom Works, which is closely associated with the Tea Party movement, took a pass on getting involved in the Arizona Senate race. They sort of said, you know, McCain's got a pretty good record on fighting earmarks.
Right.
I think he does have a lot more grassroots. That's how what Hayworth likes to put it. He says, you know, this is going to be a race of greenbacks versus grassroots. You know, in other words, McCain has millions of more dollars than he could probably raise, but Hayworth is banking on, you know, the grassroots conservatives who really for years have been annoyed with McCain. And for years here in Arizona, there was a perception that obviously he was running for president, he had national ambitions, and sort of neglected his conservative base here in Arizona. And I think there's a lot of Republicans who've been waiting a long time to maybe see McCain get his comeuppance, and they're kind of banking on Hayworth.
But back in November, a poll showed McCain and Hayworth in a tie. Now, a Rasmussen poll has McCain leading by 20%. So what happened?
I think one thing that happened is back in November, nobody was really seriously looking at the race. Hayworth had a radio show on conservative station here in Phoenix, and he talked incessantly about possibly running against McCain, criticizing McCain for being too liberal, especially on illegal immigration, issues like that, sort of like background noise. Then that November poll came out and showed it tighter than anyone thought, that a lot of people started taking a real serious look at it. And as that happened, I think McCain kind of opened up a lead.
That's Dan Nowicki of the Arizona Republic. He also writes the blog AZDC and joined us from Phoenix, Arizona. Dan, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it.
And he just mentioned Dick Armey, who also said McCain was better on fighting pork. Now, J.D. Hayworth was accused of being too close to lobbyist Jack Abramoff, although Hayworth was never charged with anything. So what is his thinking today? John McCain declined our request for an interview, but this morning we spoke with J.D. Hayworth from his campaign office in Scottsdale. We asked him first, why aren't Sarah Palin and Scott Brown endorsing him? He said, well, they're just saying thank you to John McCain for his help in their political careers. And Hayworth said his supporters aren't that happy about it.
Maybe you've seen the new social media websites that have sprung up. There's one in particular, Sarah Palin Lovers for J.D.
Well, but then there's a former Majority Leader Dick Armey. Now, as we just heard, he's behind McCain. He's also been quoted as saying that you, J.D., had a fairly short, undistinguished congressional career with virtually no initiative on your part. Ouch.
Now, a couple of things I can correct. The group Dick is a part of, Freedom Works, they're not in control of the Tea Party movement. The beauty of the Tea Party movement is it's truly grassroots. It has no designated leader. Freedom Works, on their website, put out a situation saying, no, Freedom Works is not endorsing John McCain. Dick is free to say what he wants. We understand Dick spends his time pretty much is an advocate for open borders. And so that's where his less than charitable analysis comes from.
Let's talk about immigration. You wrote a book called Whatever It Takes. You've supported an enforcement-first approach, including sending troops to the border. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I do feel that way. Let me tell you why. It's unconscionable that 10 years after 9/11, we failed to face up to the basic fact that border security is national security. But the problem with Washington, and I like John McCain a lot, but one of the reasons I'm opposing him is because he views this as a political problem to be managed instead of a security threat to be stopped.
Well, you say you like John McCain. You actually campaigned for him during the 2000 presidential race. Why are you against him now?
Because he's not the same John McCain. When I was in the Congress fighting for the tax relief, John McCain opposed those tax cuts. Then recently, you may recall that during the presidential campaign, John McCain said we ought to close Gitmo. Now he's backing away from his assertion that we should close Guantanamo Bay. And he's even saying now that he's not for amnesty for illegals, that he's for an enforcement, almost sounding like me, for an enforcement-first approach.
Well, in fact, he's also backed away from his call for cap-and-trade and climate change legislation. He was largely silent when the Supreme Court decimated his campaign financing law. Some are saying that he's tacking to the right, maybe because of you. Shouldn't that make you happier?
Well, it certainly is flattering, but is this the true conversion back to conservatism, or is it convenience for the campaign?
Well, what about you? We know you lost your run for Congress in 2006 to a Democrat, and the Arizona Republic, which wrote a scathing editorial at the time, felt it was because you changed. They endorsed you in all the years leading up to 2006, but then they wrote, not anymore. You'd become a bully who shamelessly and divisively exploited the immigration issue.
The Arizona Republic's editorial board's constant drumbeat is for open borders and for amnesty. So it would come as no surprise. I thought the ad hominem attack was a little harsh, but that's okay. But I'll tell you this, on the radio, it was my job to talk. But as a United States Senator, it'll be my job to listen. And I'm listening to people in Arizona right now saying it's time to replace John McCain with a consistent conservative.
By the way, you mentioned your radio show, and some said you used it as a bullhorn, not just to talk, a bullhorn to attack McCain. McCain apparently saw it as free advertising. He complained to the FCC, and you stepped down. And this was just recently. Do you think a radio show, you know, licensed by the government, should be used as a de facto campaign headquarters?
First of all, both the Arizona Republic and the New York Times, if you read their accounts, you would think that all I did was spend 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, doing nothing but talking about John McCain. I was talking about the news. When McCain made decisions with which I disagreed, I would say something. Here's the irony. The same week the Supreme Court struck down many of the provisions of so-called campaign finance reform championed by John McCain because the court correctly saw that it limited Americans' First Amendment rights, here was John McCain pressuring my employer to take away my First Amendment rights. And oh yeah, John won the battle. I'm off the air, and he's paid for a lot of radio time to misstate my record. But this campaign will move forward, and we will aggressively go to the people of Arizona and say, hey, look, now you've got a choice. Either a consistent conservative in J.D. Hayworth or a moderate who calls himself a maverick in terms of John McCain.
That's J.D. Hayworth, who, as he just said, is taking on John McCain, hoping to win his seat in Arizona. Congressman Hayworth, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. People can go to jdforsenate.com for more info.
Always a pro. And by the way, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org, for John McCain's contact as well. We'll have that there for our listeners in Arizona. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Well, here in New England, we may not have gotten as much snow as our neighbors to the south and west, but it's still pretty cold here, cold enough to keep some lakes and rivers frozen, cold enough for the winter ritual of ice fishing. Our resident chef, Kathy Gunn, never understood the appeal of standing on frozen water, baiting slimy worms to catch fish until she spent the day in Bodenham, Maine, with Chef Sam Hayward and his friend, Ben Zashow. They went to Bodenham to rent a fish camp from Jim McPherson, a native who's been running a smelt fishing business for more than 30 years. So with apologies to Richard Brodigan, here's Kathy's story of one cold, cold morning on Maine's Cathayance River smelt fishing in America.
My name is Jim McPherson, and I run Jim's Camps in Bodenham. And we're about to head up to what I call my special camps. It's, the fishing is pretty extreme up there. And I don't believe you'll be disappointed when we get there.
And we're going after smelts.
You're going after smelts. Yeah, rainbow smelts.
We're here. So where are we now on the river? Maybe you could tell us the name of the river.
This right here is known to the locals as Town Farm Turn. It's an area that locals have fished for probably close to 100 years up here. A spot that they just seem to bite really well, and I enjoy fishing up here. It's quiet, nice scenery. Well, let's go over to the camp and where it's warm and get you started. This particular camp we're fishing is 10 by 10, fully insulated, so it maintains a more even temperature, so you're not 100 degrees 1 minute and 50 degrees the next. And this camp has, 8 lines per side over what we call the race hole, which is the hole in the floor that you fish.
Sorry, race hole?
Race hole is what they call it. And each line has about a 2-ounce lead weight on it with a single hook hanging off the bottom. And what you do is you take the line, you drop it down until you reach the bottom, and then you bring it up about 6 to 8 inches off on the bottom, and you just wait for a fish to bite. And as the tide comes in, you have to keep checking your depth because the ice lifts, so you have to keep dropping your lines down as the tide comes in.
Oh, I think this is a perfect smelt fishing day. My name is Brent Zashow. I grew up here in Bodenham, like Jimmy. And we grew up always going smelt fishing every winter. Have you ever fished at all before?
Yep, not a whole lot, but yeah, I've done drop line fishing.
So
too.
Enough not to get
That's
the hook in your finger.
That's kind of what this is, right? Like a drop line?
It's very much like that. These are sandworms.
Okay, slimy.
Make sure the hook doesn't have anything left on it from before.
Okay, and just hook it on
and
once.
And then just hook it on there.
Like that?
Yeah, they only need one tasty little bite.
Okay. And then let it drop?
Yeah.
This one, I think we did lose our bait. How did you know that?
This is going to be unbelievable.
Okay, what's up? We got one! We got one! All right, we're in business.
We are in business. It
so
begins.
Hello smelt, yeah. Where's that bucket? How big would you say these are?
I'll take the first one off just to show you.
Okay, just slip it.
This is a really good looking smelt right here.
That's
this is
mine.
Just the right size.
Which is about 6 inches?
7 inches long, I'd say. Oh.
Hello smelt. And they're bright silver. Wow, they're really pretty.
When they really hit, it's incredible.
Just fast and furious.
And you know exactly why people do this. I've had times when we were kids, we'd go fishing and we might get one or two.
Is that right?
In 4 or 5 hours of fishing. So it can really vary. But this is a great spot here.
Got a bucket full?
We've got almost more smelts than we want to clean. But we've got over 100 fish there, easy.
Do you think? And how long are we?
And we've fished for
2 hours.
Less than 2 hours.
That's incredible.
That's very good.
It's the best ever for me.
Well, I'm glad.
They're still so moist and so firm that all I did was dip them in the flour and cornmeal mixture. I'm just going to drop them into the hot canola oil, which is only enough in the pan to come up to the middle of their backs. They're not deep frying. It's very shallow.
So we've come back with our smelts, and we're in the kitchen of Chef Sam Hayward in, what town are we in?
Bodenham.
We're going to cook up some smelts. I just have a question for you, Sam. In these recessionary times, this is pretty cheap food. Do you think that helps to the appeal? Are people buying these things? Should they know more about it?
I'm not sure people are going after smelts because it's poverty food or it's cheap, although that may play a role in its history. I think people go after smelts for its cultural context, for the fact that it's traditional to this area, and all those reasons we talked about earlier about getting out into the smelt camp, the isolation, the outdoors activity, that it's a great wintertime activity when there's really nothing much else to do if you're not a cross-country skier or a snowshoer or running snow machines all through the woods.
But for a cook or an eater, say in Boston or New York, how would you introduce them to it?
I'd tell them, first of all, it's a seasonal specialty. It's just a short time of the year that we get it. I'd let them know that this is traditional. There's something really kind of, there's a panache about it because of where it comes from, how it's caught, and how we catch them. And I'd let them know that this is one of the few fish that they can get that has this short season, that has this terrific delicacy and yet kind of flexibility and adaptability in a kitchen.